Good evening, everyone. Let's begin the Thursday talk with setting our motivation for being together tonight. The Buddha has taught that we have been cycling through samsara since beginningless time, which is an incomprehensible thought that we can't even imagine how long that is, and that we have been circling through it due to the ignorance of misconceiving how reality actually exists, and through that misconception, afflictions arising, and then due to the afflictions in our minds being propelled to create the causes for this continual cycle of being born and reborn, sometimes in the lower realms, sometimes creating the causes to be born in a fortunate rebirth, but yet still, no matter high or low, we are still caught in this circle of birth, aging, sickness, and death under the control of afflictions and karma. And so tonight I've been thinking a lot about the beautiful analogy that they teach us about the blind tortoise that has been swimming in the oceans of samsara, way down in the lower depths, sometimes coming up to the surface. And just for this fleeting life, we as the blind tortoises, tortai, have put our little snouts through this precious golden ring called a precious human rebirth. We have garnered that because in previous lives we have cultivated pure ethical conduct. We have practiced the far-reaching practices, and we have made very intentional, deep aspirations to have a precious human life. So here we are. You don't know how long it's going to last because death is certain, the time of our death totally uncertain. And so the only thing that will help us at the time of death is our practice. So tonight, as we share together this precious human life that all of us have, let's really make a strong determination to use this precious life wisely. This little small window of opportunity will close soon enough, and we don't want to lose or squander any of the opportunity that we have worked very, very hard to garner for ourselves, so that in the long term, we create the causes and conditions to have a string of precious human lives, deepening our practice, gaining realizations, understanding reality as it actually exists, for the sole purpose of becoming a Buddha, so that we can truly benefit all these kind mother sentient beings who have been cycling through samsara with us since beginningless time, to repay their unimaginable kindness and to help guide them from this cycle. So tonight let's share together the Dharma for the benefit of all. I've always loved that analogy. And kind of thinking about it tonight, along with death, Venerable has been teaching on Arya Davis 400 Stand, as she just started, and she's preparing us for a series of teachings that we're going to have here at the Abbey in July from Geshe Topke. And he's going to teach on the four chapters of Arya Davis, the first four, which have to do with the four distortions. And those four distortions being seeing things that by their nature are impermanent as permanent, seeing things that by their nature are impure as pure, seeing things by their very nature as being dukkha, as the source of our happiness, and seeing things by their very nature as being selfless, as having a self. So while Venerable's away, she'll be back next week, she had asked the community if we would share two very, very profound powerful Lamrim topics on death. One is called the 9-point death meditation, and one is called imagining our own death. And I've been thinking a lot about these lately, and what happens if we don't think about death? What happens in my mind when I forget about it? I spend a lot of my day thinking about the 8 worldly concerns, thinking about being comfortable, thinking about hearing pleasing words, avoiding admonition and criticism and harsh feedback at any cost, wondering what people think of me, and having the few things that I have as a monastic, making sure that they are special and belong to me and have a little name of Semkhe on them. And by doing that and then fretting away about the petty things, I'm not creating the causes and conditions to free myself from this cycle of samsara. And that because we have this tiny little window of opportunity, how does death help us to really understand how precious this life really is? Because when death comes, we will have to leave this precious life. And when you think about what we're leaving, we are going to be leaving everything that is familiar, everything that we know, every point of reference, our identity, the framework through which we have lived this life, and we are going to go someplace of which we do not know. So we don't know when, we don't know where, and we don't know how. And the only thing that we take with us is our karma and any of the mental habits that we have sort of perpetuated on this of this life in our mind, and that's the only thing that goes on at the time of death. So how do we look at death, at its inevitability, at its certainty, and how do we get it into our hearts rather than just saying, yeah, I know, death is coming, I'm practicing the Dharma, yes, I don't know when it's going to happen. To get it out of our heads and get it into our hearts to where it's a propelling force to deepen our determination to be free and our determination to rid ourselves of the causes and conditions that keep us in this cycle of birth, aging, sickness, and death. And thinking about death is about looking directly at what we spend our precious time doing. I mean, do we have meaningful lives? And what does that mean for each of us? What do we have at the top of our list regarding what we're doing, why we're doing, and how we're doing it? What do we spend our energy on? What do we spend our mind's incredible capacity on? Is it just the 8 worldly concerns? Or are we spending our time cultivating the causes and conditions to have a death that's going to be fearless and peaceful and open, with some sort of surety that we're going to have enough Dharma in our minds at that time that we can go there, rather than going into some sort of terrifying, petrifying state? And how do we get ourselves off this well-rutted track of thinking only about the happiness of this life? So I think with this first chapter on this first distortion, Venerable, I mean, this is a huge topic, because death is one of the gross impermanences that we all, every one of us, is going to deal with, and yet we don't think it's going to happen. We don't think it's going to happen anytime soon. And so by looking at the 9-point death meditation and imagining our death, as we go over that tonight, hopefully it will shake us up in some way to get our cushion time a little bit more precious, to get our, as Venerable said last week, get our tush on the cush, and use the death meditation not to get us all depressed and scared, but to really cultivate the causes to have a most peaceful and clear one, no matter how that unfolds. And so these two particular Lamrim meditations I've done over the past 9 years since I met the Dharma, and that the 9-point death meditation and imagining my own death were two of the meditations that I did during the 3-month retreat the year before I requested ordination. And that they were very much a propelling cause for me to request ordination. They kind of stripped away in that 3 months a complacency that had been hanging out there since I moved to the Abbey, because I figured I'd gotten, hit the jackpot here. And that by thinking about my own death and how death actually happens, it really propelled me to this incredible life that I have, and I keep using it again and again, because even as an ordained monastic, I still get complacent, I still get indifferent, I still forget, I still don't care. And so tonight I want to share some of these points and how I have used them in my life. And I'm using a transcription that came from a talk that Venerable gave in Missouri back in 2002, where she was talking about the three principal aspects of the path. And she did a lot on the nine-point death meditation. And so I wanted to share this with you with some points of my own experience and how I've used them in my life. Okay, so on the nine-point death meditation, there are three major points. First one is that death is definite or certain. The second one is that death is indefinite or uncertain. And then the third one is the only thing that's going to help us at the time of death is our practice, how much Dharma we have in our minds. Now, underneath each one of these major headings, there are three points that address the point directly. And so we'll start off with the first three points underneath death is going to happen. Everybody dies. I've been thinking about this once and saying to myself that there is not one living being on this planet, not just human family, but every sentient being on this earth is going to die. There are none that are going to avoid it. And that not only are they going to die, but included in them are all the people that I love, all the friends that I care about, my precious teachers, the dear pets in my life, the animals that I love, people who have been incredibly kind to me. There is no one that is going to escape death. And that myself included is not going to be excluded, that I also have to be prepared that someday I will be laid out in some form. Maybe at the Abbey, my corpse will be laid out somewhere. And that's all that's going to remain as my mind, my consciousness go on to my next life. So to just think that everybody, every living being is going to die, and to think very specifically about the people and the beings in our life that we care about, that we're very attached to, that they are going to die. They may die before us, they may die after us, but there is nobody, without exception, that's going to avoid this. And this is a very powerful, to sit with this. It's like death is the great equalizer. There's nobody left out. No religion, no species, no power, no strength, no negotiating. It's inevitable. That's the first point. Second one is our lifespan can't be extended when it's time to die. So there's no such thing as a pause button. There's no such thing as a stop button. There's no such thing as a rewind. There's no such thing as negotiating. That our lifespans are what they will be. And that we are alive because the causes of us to be alive exist. And once those causes cease, so do we. And we have no idea how long that's going to be. And then when you think about this, these lifespans, I think the oldest person in the world might be somewhere around 120 years of age. And that the other part of this one in particular that strikes home very deeply for me is to think that within the next 75 to 100 years, the entire inhabitants of this earth will have died. So it's not just the humans, but it's the old elephants, the old tortoises, the little tiny insects. Every living thing will have passed from this world in the next 100 years. Ananda, this building will still be here. This room may still be here. Chenrezig will definitely be here in the next 100 years. But we won't be. There'll be an entirely different configuration of people in this room. We won't be here. And that there's nothing that we can do to extend that lifespan, because the body by its very nature grows old and sick and dies. And that every moment that's passing, we're getting closer to it. That's the part that blows me away, because there are certain times of the day when I'm sleeping, when I'm on the internet, when I'm walking, when I'm eating, that I actually don't understand that my life is still passing by and that my lifespan is still decreasing. I think that's in some way that when I'm sleeping, I think that my lifespan stops and that when I wake up, it continues. When in fact, whatever I'm doing, the lifespan is decreasing moment by moment. And that when Venerable, she said that Geshe Nawan Dargye, he was always so puzzled by us Westerners, because every year we'd celebrate our birthday. He'd be so puzzled, he'd say, "Why do you celebrate the fact that you are 1 year closer to your death? I don't understand." And that is so true. I mean, we celebrate the life that we've lived, but it is also the year celebrating that we're 1 year closer to our deaths. Okay, so that's the second one, is that our lifespan can't be extended. We can't negotiate it. We can't put it on pause. And the third one is that underneath death is definite, or death is certain, is that it's going to happen even if we haven't had time to practice the Dharma. So this is one. This is the idea that we have so much going on in our life that we can put practice off until another time, because we really, truly do not believe that death is going to happen. Certainly not today. And so we put off our practice till tomorrow, when we're not so busy, when we get married and get settled, when, you know, the kids finally get to school. You know, we put it off over and over again, thinking that we have all this time, when in fact we don't. And when the time comes to our death, if we haven't practiced the Dharma, it will become very, very apparent on our deathbed that we haven't practiced. So that is the third, is that death is going to happen whether we have taken the time to practice or not. Okay, so that's the first point. Death is definite, with the three subpoints below it. And if that hasn't done anything to shift and shake things in your mind, the second one, which is the time of death is uncertain, is the one that always, well, this is the one that shakes me up the most. Okay, so underneath, the time of death is indefinite. I'm going to die. I accept that death is final. It's going to happen, but it's not going to happen right now. I've got way too much going on. I'm at the best time of my life. I'm doing so many things. I've got so many projects going on. It's simply not going to happen. I've got too many things going on. And the idea of even waking up in the morning and saying, "Today I might die," never even enters my mind. Even when I'm feeling lousy, even when I've got some illness, even when I've been in a hospital, I don't ever think that I'm going to die. And there are people that are terminally ill, there are people that are very, very old, and I bet anything that they don't even have that thought cross their mind that they're going to die. There are people who are healthy. I mean, death comes to everyone whenever it's going to happen. And it doesn't just happen to the old and the infirmed or the terminally ill. It happens to those of us who are extremely healthy, people who die in accidents. They wake up in the morning, and they certainly, when they woke up in the morning, they didn't say, "You know, today I'm going to die. I'm not going to make it back home. I'm not going to make it to work. I'm not going to make it to my son's baseball game." That doesn't even enter our minds. And there are millions of people a year, hundreds of thousands, that die by accidents. Not only do they die from car accidents or some type of catastrophes, but even these tragedies that we have in our world. You know, the tsunami and the bombings in Boston and the earthquakes in China and Hurricane Sandy. And, you know, it's like people wake up in the morning getting on with their lives. They have their breakfast, they go to work, they go out to enjoy themselves. And that's it. It's over. And not just is it over for one person, but in many of these, there are thousands of people. Never did they think in their wildest dreams that it would be the last day of their life. So the time of death is indefinite. And then so, what Venerable suggests is, oh, there's another way to look at it too, and this is the one I use sometimes to reason myself out of thinking about it. I've lived 58 years. I've been in relatively good health, So isn't it correct to assume that today I'm not going to die? I mean, the odds are working in my favor. I've come so far. I don't know, most women in America live to be in their late 80s. I've got plenty of time. You know, I can almost use logically assume that I'm not going to die today because I've lived well, I've lived healthily, and the world says I've got a good 30 years left in me. And so there it goes. I don't even think about the possibility that the fact that my life may end today. And what happens is the questions that Venerable says that we need to ask is, if I were to die right at this moment, what is the state of my mind? Would I be willing to let go? Am I ready to transition into my next life at this moment? Do I have things that are still left undone, things that are left unsaid, things that I have not taken care of in my life? That's the beauty of this particular point, the fact that death is uncertain, is that if we take it really into our hearts, we clean up a lot of the complexities of our life, the difficulties, the hurt feelings, the grudges, the difficulties. We really try to clean our plate so at the time of death we don't have any regret, even if it's one of those deaths that happens quite quickly. It's kind of like driving in a car. You're going into the Mojave Desert and your gas gauge doesn't work. You have no idea what you started off with, because at the time of conception, we don't know what our karma is. Some people come in with a full tank. Some people come in with the two-thirds of the tank. Some people come in with the needle hardly off the empty, but we don't know that. So it's kind of like that. You know, death is sort of like driving around in a vehicle that we don't know how much gas is really in the tank. The second point is, in general, there's no certainty of lifespan in our world. Okay, so this is the first. So this is the second big point that is indefinite. The first is that there's no guarantee how long we're going to live. Okay, so I was thinking about this. I said, wouldn't it be really just much more convenient if we knew that humans all live to be 97, cats live to be 18, horses live to be 24, monkeys live to be 12, butterflies lived, 6 months. If we knew that, then we could kind of get ourselves prepared when we were in our 80s, late 80s, knowing that we had about 10 years to go, that we would have some way to sort of prepare ourselves. But there's no guarantee on how long each of us is going to live. We have people who live very, very long, and then we have people that don't even make it out of the womb. And so what Venerable had us do a number of years ago that I found extremely provocative is that she asked us to make a list of all the people that we knew that had died. From the time we were little to that point, how they had died, how old they were, and what they died from, or what was the situation. And I had, before this little test that she gave us to do this little project, I honestly thought that I had not had a lot of experience with people dying in my life. There were a few that I could count. But over that week, between that Thursday and the following Thursday, I had 22 people on my list. From very, very, a baby that never even was born, stillborn, to my father who died at 93 years of age. And everybody in between, all sorts of circumstances, all sorts of ages. And there was somebody in our community, Zopa, who had, I think, 65 people on her list. She had that kind of life. She was very engaged in the community in Portland and family. I mean, 65 people. And she wasn't even 60 years old at the time, so she had more than one person die for each year of life that she had lived. An extremely sobering, humbling experience to write that list. And it helped me to get shaken up in a good way about, you could be on somebody else's list real soon here. You know, that's something to really look at. Okay, so lifespan is, the time of death is uncertain, and we have no idea what our lifespan is. And not only that, but we're going to be in the middle of doing something when we die. Even if it's our last breath, we're going to be eating, we're going to be going out to dinner, we're going to be in the middle of a conversation, we're going to be sleeping, we're going to be practicing, we're going to be driving in a car, we're going to be lying in a bed, we're going to be in the middle of a project. There's always going to be something undone, and we're going to be in the middle of something at the time of our death. So it's not like death will come when we clear the plate of all the worldly things that we have to deal with, when we get our lives together, or we get enough money, or our children are grown, or we get off work, or next time after my vacation. You know, setting up all these scenarios that once we get this done, or once we do that, or once we have that, it's a setup to just never be able to see the fact that that doesn't guarantee anything, because we have something always on our plate, and we will be in the middle of something at the time of our death. Okay, so that goes along with the lifespan is not, we'd have no certainty. And not only don't we have any certainty, but we're going to be in the middle of doing something in our life when it happens. Then the next one under the time of death is indefinite, is that there are more chances of dying and less of remaining alive. So this one really strikes home to the fragility of these bodies. That if we didn't feed this body or give it any liquid, I don't know how long it takes for a body to die if you don't hydrate it for more than a week or 10 days or 2 weeks. Venerable Jimmy, how long if you don't? Maybe a week. Yeah. If we don't put any water or any liquids into ourselves. Yet we feel we're very, very strong. The body has to be taken care of almost all the time to keep it alive. Yet there are, you know, things in this world that we don't even see that can cause our death. So to keep our bodies alive in the course of the day, we've got to find food, we've got to cook it, we've got to clean it, we've got to give it water, we have to give it shelter, we have to clothe it. And I don't know about you, but when I look over the course of my day on a 24-hour day, I have to rest it too, that there's probably about 20 hours in the course of my life that I'm doing something in regards to taking care of this body to keep it alive, which doesn't leave much time for doing anything virtuous or doing something else besides taking care of the body. So that is a very important thing to realize, that keeping ourselves alive is a full-time job. But yet dying, all we have to do is just stop drinking water, stop drinking fluids for about a week or 10 days, and we're done. And then the third point, which sort of segues into this, is that our bodies are extremely fragile. When we think about people who die from viruses and bacteria and food poisoning that we can't even see, and that it happens very quickly or it happens during a long, prolonged, painful period, but they're very, very small things that enter our bodies and they kill us. Little pieces of metal. If we pierce ourselves in a particular place in our body, we'll bleed to death. Very fragile, these bodies. But yet we spend a lot of time taking care of them and thinking that they're... Well, I know when I was younger, I thought I was pretty much immortal. There was nothing that could happen to this body to harm it. I'd get sick, I'd hurt a little bit every once in a while, but I was basically immortal. I didn't have to worry about dying. So that's the third point under the time of death is indefinite, is that it's extremely fragile, this body. And we don't know. A lot of the dangers to this body are unseen, unsuspecting. We have no idea where they are. Okay, so let's review. So far, under the first point, that death is definite, everybody dies. Our lifespan can't be extended. There's no negotiating. There's no pause button. And that we will die even without practicing the Dharma. That's for the first point. And that the conclusion then is I must practice the Dharma. If I want to have a death that's peaceful and clear without fear, and we have this precious human life right now, it's so important that we practice the Dharma, that we work on removing the obstacles to a peaceful death, to a death that's filled with bodhicitta and compassion and a mind that's somewhat together at the time. And then for the second main heading, the time of death is indefinite, the three points are that there's no certainty of lifespan and we'll probably be in the middle of doing something at the time, and that it takes a lot to keep our bodies alive and not much to have them go kaput, and then not only that, but they're extremely fragile. And that the conclusion for this one is that we need to practice the Dharma now. Okay, not tomorrow, not next week. It's this whole manana mentality, is that if we understand deeply that the time of our death, we don't know when, then the only time to practice this is right now. So it brings kind of an urgency into our practice, understanding the uncertainty of the time when it's actually going to happen. Okay, then the third point in the 9-point death meditation is that nothing can help us at the time of death except the Dharma. This one is really, as we'll see, there's a lot of things that we think are going to help us at the time of death, but simply can't. They don't have the capacity. And it's only the Dharma that's in our mind at the time that's truly going to help us through that transition. So the first one is, our money and our wealth are of no help at the time we die. It doesn't matter how rich you are, doesn't matter how poor you are, when you die, you die. It doesn't matter whether you're lying in a gutter or under a bridge, or whether you're in the best hospital in the country, under the care of a specialist, in a private room. Once again, death is a great equalizer. I had a man that I worked for many, many years ago when I lived outside of New York City in a beautiful town named Piermont, New York. His name was Jimmy. He was from the South. He was a very, very wealthy man. He lived in a reproduction of a southern antebellum mansion in Piermont, New York. It was quite overgrown. And he had he hired me as his gardener. You wouldn't know he had a lot of money because the place was quite disheveled. He was quite disheveled. And a number of times in the evening after our work, we'd spend time out on the porch drinking glasses of vodka and such. But and I worked for him for a few years, very generous. And then one day I heard that he had gone out to lunch with a mutual friend of ours and that he had choked on a piece of his lunch. It was in his late 70s. And so there he was, going to have a good time with all the wealth in the bank, this beautiful home on the river, the Hudson River, and he was gone, just by going out to enjoy himself. And that really quite shook me up at the time, realizing that here's someone that I knew personally. You know, when it hits home personally, this is where practice can really be utilized more deeply, is that the people in our lives, when things happen to people that we care about, that we know, instead of going into a place of sadness or depression or upset, is we take that onto the path, we take that into our practice and use it as a gift. So no matter how much money, no matter how much wealth, when we die, we can't take it. It's left behind for our family. Many times we hear these tragic stories of people dying with a certain amount of wealth or only the things that they've acquired during that life, and that their family just spends all of their time wrangling and fighting over whatever was left behind. And there's all these hard feelings, and they go to court, and they sue each other. There's just a big mess over all of the material possessions, of which the deceased has no use for anymore, but is causing a lot of bad feelings. So wealth is not all that is cut out to be, first of all, for the person who's died, and sometimes for the family that's left behind to have to deal with all the possessions. Okay, so that's the first of the points underneath. Nothing can help us except the Dharma. So money, possession, stuff. Doesn't matter. The second one, our friends and our relatives are of no use. And this one gets to be a little bit more difficult because at the time of death, we could have our spiritual teacher with us. We could have our spiritual friends. They could be reminding us of what to practice. They could be chanting with us. They could be really encouraging us and being with us in all those good ways possible. But if our minds haven't practiced the Dharma and we haven't taking responsibility for preparing our own minds, no matter what they do, it could help us. But at some point, we are completely responsible for what the state of our mind is and how much of that we're capable of taking in, how much of their Dharma advice and their encouragement and their prayers we can really utilize to keep ourselves present in the Dharma at the time of death. And as Venerable says in the transcription here, is that when we die, our friends and relatives stay here and we go on alone. None of them accompany us. It is an adventure. It is a solo adventure, a solo flight. So we think about all the relationships and all the people that we've met and all the people we hold dear, all of our mentors, our Dharma friends. At the time of death, It is our experience and our experience alone. There's nobody else who can share it with us. Nobody else who can prevent it, slow it down, renegotiate for us. We are doing it alone. And so one of the practices that, because I know that many of us are afraid of being alone. You know, people who have very, very tight family-knit groups, they spend time with their families, they spend time with their friends, they call their mother three times a week, they email this person, they text that person. That there, for many of us, being alone is somewhat of an unsettling experience. And so I have been thinking that it might not be a bad idea to get used to being alone, to lighten up the social calendar, so spending time just with our own minds, without any email, without any calls, without any family and friends, to do this as a practice. Because at the time of death, we are going to be totally alone. So maybe making friends with ourselves and getting used to being a solitary, solo person in a space with just me and my mind would not be a bad thing to start to practice, especially for those of us who are extremely attached to our family and friends and our pets and stuff. It really would be helpful. The other part that helps me in regards to friends and family and relatives is that being attached to what they think of me and how they appreciate me and how they acknowledge me and when I get feedback and when I get criticism. Sometimes I find myself walking outside in the on the trails here and I say to myself, you know, Semke, how much of how other people appreciate and acknowledge you and admonish you or criticize you or hurt your feelings, how much of that is part of the cooperative conditions for you to have a peaceful death? How much of that really is going to matter as far as your awakening and your liberation? What people think of you, how they talk to you, how they care about you. That doesn't really matter. You know, it's kind of like getting myself sort of untangled by my attachment to reputation and my attachment of having praise and having and avoiding criticism. Is at the time of death, whatever people have ever thought about me, whatever they've acknowledged or appreciated about my good qualities or admonished me for my not-so-good qualities, all of that just falls away. And the only thing that's left is the afflicted state of mind that I've had being attached or having an aversion to those things. So I've really tried to use another way to kind of loosen my grip on my relationships in this life with my teacher, with my community, with my family, is to say, you know, the state of your mind is the most important, to have a healthy and loving relationship with them, but to not get caught up in the eight worldly concerns in regards to them, because it really doesn't help. In fact, they're huge obstacles to the state of my mind at the time of death. Okay, so that's the second. Our friends and family are of no use at the time of death. And then the third one, at the time of death, even our body is absolutely of no help. So since the very time of conception, the one thing that we have had totally embodied with us, totally enwrapped, enshrouded, covered, walking, being with, living with, responding to, having experiences through it, transporting us from point A to point B. These bodies we've had all of our lives. That's something that we know more than anything better in the world. At the time of death, even this abandons us. Even this we can't take with us. That's like an ultimate shakeup, you know? And for all the time that we've spent taking care of it, all the time that we've groomed it and pampered it, at the time of death, it stays behind. The most intimate relationship we've had is with this body. And at the time of death, bye-bye. And so when I think about sometimes just for my own practice, it's very, very helpful for me to look at some of these celebrity magazines. Sometimes when I'm at the dentist office, I'll look at People magazine. And I see all of these people that their whole celebrity, their fame, a lot of it depends on how they look, how beautiful they are, how handsome they are. Recently, the sexiest man alive this year is Chad Tanning, I think his name is. I don't know who he is. He's quite handsome, very chiseled face, green eyes, you know, very chiseled body, seems to be a nice guy. Sexiest woman alive this year is Gwyneth Paltrow, I guess. You know, these beautiful, successful, famous, wealthy, And you know, if you watch them long enough, they get the gray hair, all the operations, whatever, the facelifts, the exercise, the personal trainers. After a while, they get old, they get sick, and they die. You know, no matter the fame, no matter the beautiful bodies. And to have, I always find myself really having this kind of open-hearted understanding and compassion. I mean, that's what they've chosen, but they're kind of, that's where they are, and the world's got them in that beautiful golden handcuff clutch right now. And that my heart just opens and saying, wow, to have all of that fame because I've got a body that's beautiful. I'm like, whoa. So I have a lot of compassion, I guess empathy for folks that really have their whole life circled around how their bodies look. Or, you know, they're great photographers, great cook, you're a great scholar, whatever our claim to fame is at the time of death, all of that gets left behind. And so then the conclusion for this heading of the only thing that we take with us, the only thing that works for us at the time of death is the Dharma, is that we need to practice purely. So that we need to not only practice it now, but we need to transform our minds to make them really strong, to make them really joyful, so that at the time of death, the practice is, as best as we can, sustained somewhat as a default, so that at the time of the death, maybe refuge will arise, maybe bodhicitta will arise, maybe the kindness of our teacher will arise. Not all the, you know, all the accolades that we've had of sharing the Dharma, or all the offerings that we've gotten, or how many YouTube videos we've done, or how many sharing the Dharma days we've done, or how many precepts we've kept, or anything like that. It's like using it to really practice so that our minds at the time of death will be so clear, or at least to a point where we've got the Dharma in there. You know, I can't even imagine. Will I have my teachers, will I have Venerable's face in my mind at the time of death and think of her incredible kindness and wish to see her, to have her as my teacher again? Will I think about refuge? Will I think about emptiness? That who is dying right now? Can you imagine having that kind of mind? And right now, practicing purely is about that. And one of the things that we have here, that Venerable, she really makes a very powerful point here, is that she said, because we have our own, we don't have our own internal discipline, here at the Abbey we have a schedule, you know? Because when we have an understanding of death and impermanence, we are self-disciplined from our own side. We don't need to have group meditation. We don't need to have offering service. We don't need to have somebody telling us when to do things and the teachings. That by the sheer understanding of the time of death and the uncertainty of it, and that it's definite, we're almost propelled by our own determination to be present to our lives, that we know the power of purification, we know the power of practice, we know how crucial cultivating merit is, to put aside the hurt feeling, to put aside the attachment, the anger. And that nobody needs to tell us to go and meditate. Nobody needs to tell us to be kind. We have our own internal motivation because we've meditated on a permanence in death. And she had, and that's so amazing, that if we can get that into our minds, our practice will come as the first thing that we want to do, and how we're going to create the cause and conditions to have not only a peaceful death, but to have precious human rebirths, one after the other, so that we can propel ourselves to awakening for the benefit of all. So that's practicing purely, to somehow get ourselves on the cushion with that kind of determination from really contemplating our own death and the uncertainty of it, and that our practice will be the sustaining cause for the death to be a peaceful one. And then what I wanted to do for the last 15 minutes is that instead of talking about imagining our death, I'm going to lead us through the meditation itself, so that we can really get a sense of practicing this, doing a dry run. And because we have such amazing imaginations, it's very helpful to start imagining our death and what our minds are going to be like and how is it going to unfold and how is it going to run itself out. And so it's very helpful to do this meditation. And because it's only in our imagination, every time that we do this, we can set up a different scenario. So tonight we can start with something that's very, we've had, just set up the scenario. We have our spiritual teacher there. We have our spiritual friends. We're not in a lot of pain. We're very lucid. We've been practicing. And then just set it up that way, or set it up as a real quick, sudden, terrifying. The car is spinning out of control. It's flying through the air, and it's about to impact the ground, and here I am. Okay, so let's do this. Let's take a moment to imagine a circumstance, one that maybe you feel somewhat comfortable about putting in your imagination, or one that you just would be totally terrified about thinking about. Where are you? What's happening? How are you dying? Are you alone? Are you with friends? Are you with a stranger? What's the level of pain? What's your body look like? How old are you? Really fill in all the details. Really let your imagination just unleash. What's happening in your mind? What's the reaction of your friends and family? If they're not with you, imagine what will be their reaction when they hear of your death. How will they deal with it? And imagine as you're lying there, these questions come to your mind. How have I lived my life? Can I accept my life without regret? Or is my mind troubled by words unspoken, things undone? As you're lying there and your life passes before you, what are the good things? What are the virtuous things at that moment you can really rejoice in having done? List a few. And then what do you regret? And the regret comes with just an acceptance of mistakes in life, places that we may have harmed. So look over your life and list one or two things that at the moment of death, if they were still there unfinished, unsaid, what would they be? And then while you're still conscious and lucid before the elements begin to absorb, think of one thing of the Dharma that you have practiced in your life, that has called to you, that you've loved practicing, that you've really made a heart connection with. And imagine at the time of death calling that to mind. And put that in your mind right now. What would it be? If you could have one understanding of the Dharma to be there at the time of death, which of the Buddha's teachings would you hold in your heart? And then you bring yourself back up to the present moment, away from your death scenario. And try to connect with the importance of making your life meaningful. From this meditation, what have you learned about your mind? What have you learned about what's important? What you need to take care of? And make very specific conclusions about what you want to do and what you want to change from now on. Because someday, one day, it's not going to be just in our imagination. One thing you want to take with you from this meditation. So whatever we have garnered from this topic of death, that it is an impermanent phenomena, that our lives, our bodies, impermanent, let's dedicate whatever we have garnered tonight, whatever insight, whatever wisdom we have learned about our own minds, whatever resistance, whatever opening, let's acknowledge it. And let's dedicate all of that merit, that thoughtfulness, that pondering, the well-being of all beings. And may tonight be some small cooperative condition that contributes to our own awakening in order to benefit others. And that may death be our good friend from now until its arrival, reminding us to practice the Dharma, to practice the Dharma right now, and to practice it purely. Let's dedicate. Due to this merit, may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore.